Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. Now, it's a very special show today because we're going to be talking about attitudes, paradigms, belief systems, and a world that most of us don't even interact with on a daily basis. And it's a world that I think is fascinating, as well as the people that we're going to be talking about. We are going to be talking with Jim Hannon. His movie is called Little Town of Bethlehem. And Jim, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's my pleasure.
When I have to be honest with you, when I first got the movie for review and I looked at the cover of it, I thought, oh, good gracious, what have I gotten here? Because it depicts someone from the Middle East. There's no real face shown, but it's just the whole front cover. And for me, I just went, I don't know if I really am interested in this. I was making a judgment, but I put the film, the DVD, into the equipment, and I'll tell you, I was fascinated and literally captivated by the film and the message that it brought forth. I think you have done something exceptional here, and I just really was intrigued with all the different perspectives that were presented in this film. Jim, Little Town of Bethlehem is about the conflict among the Israelis, the Palestinians, and so many different things that have been going on for so many years. Mm-hmm. How in the world did you get to the point where you decided you wanted to put this kind of film together?
Well, I'm really appreciative of how you just described it, because I myself was fascinated by the points of view as we went into this world and as we explored kind of what was possible. And as I saw more and more of what was possible, we did realize that there was a story here that a lot of people in the Western world just are not that familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the United States, and I'm just pretty familiar with an Israeli or a Jewish narrative coming from a Christian background myself. But I really didn't understand much of an Arab narrative, and certainly not a Palestinian narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we began the project by looking at the conflict between the Muslim and Christian world and between the Western and the Arab world. And we went to Jordan, and we went to Lebanon, and we just started talking to Muslim leaders and Arab leaders, but we couldn't get very far into any conversation until the Israeli-Palestinian issue was sort of addressed. And we realized then that was really what we needed to sort of explore first. And again, I was much more familiar with the Jewish narrative or the Israeli
mm-hmm.
narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we wanted to find hope. We wanted to find where there's an answer. This is a conflict that I've grown up with all my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've heard about this. I've seen the different political solutions. And we like to find stories of real people who, by their choices and by their actions, their lives actually mean something,
mm-hmm.
not just what they say. And so we looked and found Sami Awad, who's a Palestinian Christian, who is working to build, nonviolent movement throughout the Palestinian and Israeli communities. He networks with many of them, and we were captivated by his story, and I'm
mm-hmm.
glad to hear that you were too.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. What I found so refreshing, this is a very difficult topic, and usually I choose not to get into any kind of a political situation, and that's what I liked about your movie. Because it was a discussion of real people who are living in these environments. And those of us here in the Western world and in other parts of the world, we're not living that. We're not in this quagmire of disorientation many times. Because let's face it, we human beings are very self-centered. And usually we are able to deal with just in what's our immediate space. Yet you had three individuals here that you had Sammy, you had Ahmad. Now, if I'm not getting the names right, do correct me. And then Jonathan.
Yeah.
Do I have the names right?
Yeah, Sammy, Ahmad, and Jonathan.
Okay. When I was watching the beginning parts of the movie, so frequently things are glamorized about the Middle East or romanticized. Maybe I should use that terminology.
Good.
Without people really having the integrity or the honesty to talk about the bare bones of what's really going on in the environments there.
Yeah.
And I've done some interviews in the past with people that many years ago, these individuals are elderly now, but they have memories of a Middle East that was much different than what we see in today's world. There was a time when many areas of the Middle East, including Lebanon, were considered absolutely cosmopolitan, people from all over the world, all kind of ethnic backgrounds. Everybody was getting along. I'm not saying everything was hunky-dory and peachy-keen, because you're always going to have disruptive environments come up and cause discord. But it was an environment where people wanted to be because it was, again, I'll use the word cosmopolitan. It was marvelous because you had this cross-cultural interaction and communication. And then
that's
that
really
changed.
Yeah,
it changed.
Tragically so. And I mean, I'm very glad for a lot of things that you just shared about these authentic voices, because, you know, I'm not a historian and I'm not a scholar, so I really didn't, and I didn't want to make another film that just had one expert talking about to another expert and one side giving their point of view, another side giving their point of view. But I felt people would be very interested in hearing from people who live there, and these people know their stories better than any expert does. So how can I just get them to tell their stories? And so we took, you know, Sammy Awad, the Palestinian Christian, Ahmad Al-Azza, he's a Palestinian Muslim, and Yonatan Shapira is an Israeli Jew. And now they didn't grow up really knowing each other, but they grew up knowing the conflict, and they grew up, you know, seeing the conflict from their filters and from their, you know, boyhood experiences. So it's fascinating to watch the film, to hear their stories, and to see them come together when they start to talk about how each of them arrived at nonviolence as a means of equality.
This is significant, and I think here we are in a brand new year. We have, at any given time on this planet, over 200 conflicts where human beings are doing atrocious things to other human beings because of hates or something. Maybe they didn't like the purple scarf you had on your head or whatever. I mean, it's really, really atrocious what we human beings can do to each other. I want to talk a bit about Jonathan Shapira, because this very, very intelligent Israeli officer is someone, I love the way he talked about what his family went through, how his family came into a particular area of the Middle East in 1933, and conflicts started evolving, and what his family went through. Tell us a little bit about him and his background.
Well, you know, his grandparents were pioneers, and they were settlers. They made aliyah, as he would say. They went to help on a Zionist level, help even establish the state of Israel. And they were in the land when, you know, Israel was born as a nation. And so they saw the conflict sort of emerge and what had happened kind of through that. His father, of course, everyone in Israel serves in the military, and his father was a commander in the Yom Kippur War. And Jonathan talks about this. He talks about what it's like to be on a base, what it's like for this, you know, family groups to be very tight, because you've got the men and women fighting, and you don't know if someone's going to come back, so they really are just a real tight, supportive kind of a group. And he sees the conflict from that perspective, and he wants to be like his father. He wants to be a pilot. He wants to defend Israel. And he's taught to believe that, you know, they are the weaker, and also that, you know, all of these forces in the world are trying to drive them to the sea. So it's really interesting for him to look back on his childhood, reflect on those things, then for him later in life to see what has happened in the unfolding years since the Palestinians became refugees and have yet to be settled, have yet to mm-hmm. sort of find an issue, and how that created a conflict within him. I identified with him very much, and he's become a very good friend, and he is very eloquent. He's got a great mm-hmm. way of speaking and sharing, mm-hmm. and very relaxed. But also, anybody that's doing nonviolence pays such a price, you know, and you're really misunderstood because both sides, if you start talking about empathizing or connecting with the other side, you begin to be perceived as compromising your security or compromising, you know, mm-hmm. your support for your nation. So these men coming together, setting aside, struggling within their own communities as well as within a global community, but each of them had a crisis of conscience, and I loved Yonatan's crisis of conscience because he's very articulate and he loves his father. His father didn't agree with Yonatan. Yonatan chose to write a pilot's letter and refuse to fly into occupied territories on missions that involved attacking civilian populations. He got to the point where he couldn't do that in his own mm-hmm. journey. Mm-hmm. And he shares about that with the other pilots. He shares about a group of pilots that shared that conviction with him, and they wrote this letter. And then the fallout that happened to him and to some of the other pilots because of it. So here he is paying a pretty high price, but it's something that he really believes in. And this is something I found, you know, in all of the people there, that they don't necessarily have to stay there. They all have sort of relatives and friends in other parts of the world, but they choose to stay there. They choose to make the hard choice, even raising their families in this environment, because they believe they can make a difference, and they believe if they make a difference there, it can affect the whole world.
And I think that is tremendous wisdom. I think of how the United States, it was people who collectively had such a strong belief in the idea of freedom, they sacrificed everything they had. And there's 22 men that were acknowledged, them and their families. Their families said, if this is what you want to do, then this is what you must do. And so I think the price of freedom and the understanding that war is such a waste and the brutalities that occur are just unconscionable. I think that it speaks well of these people, even though they came from such diverse backgrounds. Now, Akbad was in the Palestinian tent. This is something I had no knowledge of. I was not aware that the United Nations had set up an area where there were, I forget how many tents, and that tent city still stands 60-some years later. And that is mind-boggling. That is absolutely mind-boggling. Tell us a little bit about that and about Akbad.
Yeah, I was very surprised to see the refugee camps that still existed since 48. Now, they are no longer tents per se. There are some certain shelters that are like that, but these communities have all formed, and this is something I don't think a lot of people do realize, Donna. I mean, imagine being moved into a refugee camp and being told that, you know, in 2 weeks or within 2 months, there'll be an issue where you can move back home or something better will happen. But nothing happens for 60 years. And there you are in that camp and having to raise your families, and your families expand, but the area that you've been given to live in doesn't expand. So literally they've had to build on top of the houses that they've built, and now some camps are 4 and 5 stories high simply because mm-hmm. the population has expanded, but the room has not. And these are amazing communities because they're not necessarily governed towns. They're just Palestinian families that have been kind of grouped together, and so their plumbing, their electricity, how they even function, you know, within the camp is something they've just had to figure out. It's mm-hmm. it's amazing that they've had to do that. I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm horrified that there is violence there. I'm horrified at certainly suicide bombings and these type of things, but given certain conditions, I'm also not surprised at them. What is amazing is that Ahmad and many of his family also, I mean, they know militants. It's a tight community. But they choose, you know, they found a courage, let's say. They found a purpose through nonviolence that they can struggle and they can believe for something better for that whole region and for themselves. mm-hmm. without having to do violence. It's one of the strongest impacting things, you know, in my own life that I've experienced for quite some time.
I can imagine. Now, this particular refugee area that you show in the film, which I think is just fascinating to see because it looks like it's ready to topple over. I mean, I don't even know how it stays up straight. It's a ramshackle kind of a structure. There were 900 people originally in these camps, and now there's well over 2,000 people since it was first established. So you've got a real, and as Akbad said, there's no privacy. There's absolutely none. Everything is just on top of each other. Now, his family, his grandparents, they came in to an area of country, and his mother, he said, was a year old, and there was some pretty tough stuff that happened to them. To give us a little background on Ahmed's family.
Yeah, now his heritage in the area goes back, he doesn't even know how many generations, you know, could go back to 10, 20, 30 generations. They kind of had lived there. They lived in Beit Jabrin, which is just sort of 10 miles or so from Bethlehem. And yes, in 1948, his mother was just a child. I don't think his father was even born yet. But they were ushered in, and, you know, because of the war, and people don't realize this, there was a war in 48, and the Arab nations did attack Israel, and Israel did defend itself, and these elements happened. But there was an enormous civilian population of Palestinians really sort of caught in all of that, and what had mm-hmm. happened in the outcome of the wars. They became refugees, but they were moved, and the United Nations sort of had to, well, made promises to them that they weren't able to keep, and then some of these people, including Ahmad's mother, you know, was just brought into this camp, meaning that his dad was born in the refugee camp, and just a few years ago his dad died. So his dad spent his entire life in the refugee camp.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things with Ahmad is that he just has this wisdom that says, don't paint all of us with the same brush. There are the militants, we are against them. This is not something we support, but it has disturbed him deeply that no one takes the time to really find out about the people that are going about their daily lives. And I think that they're just like any other people on the face of this planet. They want to just take care of their families. They want to have a place to have their home and live a comfortable life, and they really don't want to be involved in war. I think if historically you look at any people on this planet, in general, most of the population don't even want to have that consideration. It's not what they want to spend their lives dealing with, is battling, being in, you know, living in fear and terror, and their children and everyone starving and horrific things happening. This isn't what they want. So often it's about maybe 1% of the population, and maybe I'm being, just a little flippant with this, but it's a very tiny amount of the population of any country at any time that can create havoc for millions. It doesn't take tens of thousands of people doing it. All it takes is a few. And then you have the fear, and then the ignorance comes in, and anger, and all good common sense goes out the window. Now, Sami Awad, he is a man that has been in the United States. He had traveled over here, and in the movie that you made, Little Town of Bethlehem, I found it intriguing that he said whenever he talked to someone in the United States, they just didn't have a clue of what was going on. What was being covered in our media was very myopic. And so he's quite a well-spoken man. All of these men are very, very well-spoken.
Well, that's what I found, too. And they found, you know, they've had to become very well-spoken. They've had to become really almost nonviolent warriors in a way. They have such a poise and a dignity about them and sort of this posture of, I know you're not going to understand, and I know, you know, I'm going to start beginning from this standpoint where you have this picture of me that isn't accurate. But they're able to accept that, which is pretty amazing. Not a lot of people can do that. Mm-hmm. But I think that they've realized the patience that they need. I mean, so to make the film, we lived with Ahmad for a few days, you know, that refugee camp that we were in. We got to know the people. They are an amazing people. They are, just as you described, the average people that you would expect any human being thrown in that environment, you know, to kind of be like. And they were all very surprised that the Western media and that their story, well, that they were characterized, maybe the entire population is characterized as terrorists, that just this faction that, that is violent, you know, sort of paints them all with that brush. And because so many Christians do make pilgrimages to the Holy Land, so many people do come there, but they all stay on the Israeli side. They never really go into the West Bank. I think they're told that it's not safe, but you know, we were quite safe when we were with them, and it was an amazing, you know, cultural experience. Yeah, for them to have the patience and to be able to say, I know I'm not understood, but I'm going to continue to talk with you and help you understand, is a pretty gracious thing. And I think that that grace is in the film.
Very much so. Well, on the part of all three of the primary individuals that you interviewed, whose uncle established the Center for Nonviolence in the 1980s? Martin Luther King was the inspiration and still is the inspiration for these people.
Yeah, that was Mubarak Awad. That was Sammy Awad's uncle. And that's what really got Sammy into it. He was young. He was 16 when the first Intifada broke out, which is the first civil unrest, which was an amazing thing. A lot of people don't know too much about it, but it was like the racial riots that happened in the United States during Dr. King's time. You know, Dr. King championed nonviolence, but there was a lot of different things happening at that time with Malcolm X and different other people that, that really maybe weren't so nonviolent. And so the racial riots were happening, and he sort of was able to give a cohesiveness and a voice and an identity and a purpose to the people through nonviolence, which ultimately allowed the world to participate and much more of the, even the white population in the United States, to get behind them. That's what we hope for the nonviolence movement and the Palestinians with Sammy. Mubarak started it. He started the Center for Nonviolence. The first Intifada broke out. There was it took everybody by surprise. It wasn't sort of too much of a planned thing. It's just that the civilian population got to a breaking point and started to demonstrate. It surprised the Palestinian Authority as well as the Israeli Authority. And and so, you know, Sammy talks about this. He talks about how empowering and how much that meant to him as an impressionable 16-year-old to see people, to feel like you're totally, you know, have no control, that you're at the forces of these, or at the mercy of these political forces, but to see a people stand up for itself and find dignity and build community, I think really shaped his life. Now, Mubarak was subsequently deported, you know, at that time, and so when Sammy came back, it was very, very much with the understanding that he might not be able to stay either, but he continues the work that he does.
An amazing story. Now, with Little Town of Bethlehem, there is the segment where these men end up finding each other. Tell us how that occurred. How were they able to link up with a common cause? Because they all are still very much involved in trying to bring together a cohesive understanding so that people will stop killing each other.
Yeah, they've really dedicated themselves to it. They know that the alternative is absolutely horrible, so they all continue and they build, and we hope the film, you know, helps them do that. They found each other just because different groups began to, you know, the nonviolent community was fairly small, you know, it's growing. And when one, there's success by one, and the Palestinians know each other, they can sort of leverage and sort of connect. Well, as you hear in the film, Yonatan was one of the founders of a group, Combatants for Peace. And these are ex-soldiers. These are soldiers that really did fight against each other on both sides, Palestinians and Israelis, who really heard that about one hears about another, and that's kind of how nonviolence grows. It grows kind of one person at a time, and one person is encouraged by another person, and that becomes a group, and that group encourages another group. So that's really how they found each other. Well, Sammy had seen this Combatants for Peace group come together. He knew a lot of the fighters that were on the Palestinian side. and how they had met in Bethlehem with the Israelis. It was a very tense meeting because neither one had any guarantees that this was going to work, and the Palestinians thought that the Israelis were actually just spies and were taking all down all their names, and the Israelis mm-hmm. thought the Palestinians were just going to kill them. But they had the courage to try this, and they had the faith to try this. They knew that they needed to do something. And that's when they sort of were able to see each other as human, which is an amazing thing. They were able to not see this person as an enemy, but see this person as a father, as a brother, as someone else who's struggling just like they're struggling. And once they saw that, once they actually said, well, this is a human being just like I am, and once they saw that equality and could grant that equality to each other, changed the entire paradigm. And that's how the group Combatants for Peace was born. And that's grown to almost 800, you know, people now. And that's really how, you know, Sammy heard about Yonatan, heard about the group, and they connected. And then Ahmad, who lives in Bethlehem and grew up in the refugee camp, he heard about what Sammy was doing with nonviolence, and he wanted to help. He wanted to bring that to the Muslim community because he mm-hmm. knew that component was going to be very important. I mean, the faith communities are very strong there. You've got a very strong Jewish community, of course. You've got a very strong Muslim community. And there's a struggling sort of marginalized and fairly small Christian community, but still, they've been there for centuries. So that element of faith needed to be, well, it's just a part of life there. When you talk about it, the way that it was before in the metropolitan communities and the way that it was, there was an understanding that people had very strong, you know, bases for their faith, but they didn't have to see the other as less or as an enemy because of it.
Right.
I think that's more of a thing that has happened more through the media and more through, the perceptions of America as a Christian nation, and yet our participation in the wars that happen in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating, I think, a very fascinating film, because you're getting very objective feedback from three different positions. Each individual had gone through their own experiences, their training, their indoctrination, and yet they said, we have to get past this, because what is evolving is just total mass destruction. Most people don't want to even do this. Why are we giving other people the right to make our choices for us when we can make our own and live in peace? And I think that's very, very powerful. And I was intrigued that Yonatan has come into the United States. I'm assuming he's still here and is still working as a helicopter pilot, because the Israeli army, I know, was very upset with him. And his father ended up, along with the entire family, being behind Yonatan. And I think that is also an amazing story. Your movie, Little Town of Bethlehem, is, I think, a very moving, it's a very insightful movie, it's a very educational movie, because instead of being given dogma, you have three human beings, along with some phenomenal photography that you put there, that you took there, but I think it's very real, and I think it is a good statement about the value of becoming knowledgeable and saying we can have peace. We do not have to have these horrific things occurring. It doesn't need to be perpetuated generation after generation after generation. There is a better way. And that's what your movie, Little Town of Bethlehem, really gives. Now, for my audience, would you please tell them how they can, Jim, find your website. Where do they go to get more information about the movie?
Certainly. But first, Don, I just want to thank you on behalf of Yonatan, Ahmad, and Sammy. I mean, you are helping others know of their story and helping, you know, their voice, you know, be considered. And we all appreciate that very much and appreciate everything that you're doing. Now, your audience can just go to egmfilms.org. And they can order the film, and they can see how they could screen it with their groups or universities. And we thank you so much for calling, you know, people's attention to this important story.
It is an important story, because and for those of you who are listening, it's important because we need to understand that hate is something that serves no one well. And when we have generation after generation after generation that is indoctrinated with this, we're going to get the same garbage, the same destruction, the same misery over and over again. So if three men like this, and I know there's hundreds of others throughout this planet, there should be millions, but they're in a small minority too frequently. But if we're willing to educate ourselves, if we're willing to watch movies like Little Town of Bethlehem and understand there's other positionings of understanding, we can, one person at a time, make a difference. Doesn't mean you play the role of coward. Doesn't mean you play the role of fool. It means you educate yourself. And this movie goes a long way towards bringing a different paradigm of understanding. Jim Hannon, thank you so much for being my guest today. Again, the movie is Little Town of Bethlehem. Go to their website, egmfilms.org. You can also go to littletownofbethlehem.org. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be right back. Don't go away.
Hi, this is Rio, host of the Hooked on Raw radio show on rawenergyradio.com. If you're interested in the raw and living food lifestyle, along with the real story of what's happening to our health freedoms, and you don't mind a little controversy, listen to my radio show and podcasts on rawenergyradio.com. Each week, we interview guests and cover topics you won't hear on mainstream radio. Get informed, healthy, and involved. rawenergyradio.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And I just love talking to people that are out there doing good things. Isn't it wonderful to know that there are people that are walking the talk? They're not just blabbing. They're sincerely committed, and somehow or another, they come together, and little by little, in little tiny steps, they're making changes and they're making differences. Don't ever underestimate yourself. You never know who you're going to meet or what you're going to find that you can do for yourself that is going to empower another human being. You see, we can't do things all by ourselves. We need to have the support. We need to have those individuals that are going to say, we can make this world a better place. Now, there's always going to be the yo-yos out there that say, no, let's destroy everything. That's just the way it is, because they want to dominate everything. They want to take everything over. There's always that tiny percentage. But as I said during my interview with Jim today, they really are a very small percentage. The only thing is they got big mouths, and often they intimidate. They say, I will take what you've got. You either do it my way, or you're dead, or you're on the highway. I mean, they come through with all this stuff. Look at all the garbage that's promoted on television. Programs that have nothing to do with reality. But people watch it enough, they think that that is the reality. It isn't. And sometimes to see the reality, you have to step into a space of experience and walk in someone else's shoes to find out what that reality really is. And one of the things that I feel that makes the United States an exceptional place is that you have the opportunity to do that and more if you want to do it in this country. In a lot of places in the world, you would not even begin to have that opportunity. You wouldn't begin to have it. So respect what you've got, respect who you are, and know that you can make a difference, because you can. Donna Sebo here. Hey, if you want to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Give me a call at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And by the way, if you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, let me tell you what I perceive, and you then can welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. Yes. Now, I've got some more astrological stuff to share with you. I think I'm going to have time today to talk about those of you under the sign of Leo, Virgo, and Libra, because we've already covered Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer. So this is just sort of a basic kind of 2011 horoscope. But before I do that, I want to go off on a little bit of a different tangent. The oldest octopus unveiled. That's right, octopus. You know, there are people out there that are doing research all the time, and they find some unusual things. And this particular item of discovery is about 95 million years old. Wrap your mind around that. It's even, I think at 95 million, we just talk about that like it's popcorn. I mean, it's amazing. It's a huge, huge number. Well, apparently, the discovery was made of fossils, five octopuses. They met their end in an area in and around Lebanon. Fascinating stuff. Now, what happened that enabled the preservation was that there was a lack of oxygen on the local seafloor. And consequently, that area was free of any kind of bottom-dwelling scavengers, and sediment covered the corpses of these five octopus. And they were preserved so perfectly, every detail of their anatomy is visible. And Dick Fuchs of the Free University of Berlin and his colleagues, when they found this, they made the discovery that they're the most ancient ones ever discovered. Now, of course, it's such a delicate fossil. And they said the natural structure of the octopus, it's very soft in its tissue structure. To be able to get the preservation of these soft creatures, he said, it was just coincidence. And he said, it was just a bunch of lucky chances where we discovered them. Now, previously, there's only been one single species, a prehistoric octopus, that turned up on a fossil record. So this enables them to find out more about this absolutely amazing animal. Octopuses, they are so intelligent. I saw a film once where they had been put in these huge glass aquariums. Now, the top on the aquariums were open. And they would have certain sections of aquariums that had food for the octopus. They like crab. They like all kinds of goodies, you know, lobster, this type of thing. And they'd lock the lab up. They'd come back in the morning, and all the food was gone. Well, they set up some cameras to find out what was happening because nobody had entered. Nobody had broken into the lab, and everything was just like the way it was supposed to be. What they found was that the octopus knew that food was in these other aquariums, got out of its own aquarium, went across the floor, and crawled into the other one, munched out, left, went back to its own place. They did not have any clue that this creature was doing this. It can manage its body in an amazing way. So 95 million years ago, maybe even further back than that, these creatures have occupied Earth. And these particular five octopus, they found they were of a different species. So they say it's just amazing. The common octopus that we recognize at this time, that is something that goes back a long, long way. And they said, in appearance with what they found, the modern octopods developed much earlier than previously thought. Don't you just love it? Don't you just love it when somebody who thinks they know it all, then all of a sudden someone in a place like Lebanon, they find something like this. And they go, excuse me, but I think we need to change the information in the history books. Well, with the phenomenal creature, the octopus, they're definitely having to change history's recording of their previous ancestry. Goes back a long way. Donna Sebo here, 888-815-9756. Now, I want to let you know who is coming online. I'm still having problems getting in with my computer. We've had some kind of a problem with our system, but I'm going to let you know who's going to be on the air with me tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Cammie McBride. Her publication is about Herbal Kitchen. This woman has done an amazing job breaking down herbs, giving all kinds of information about how valuable they are to us. So we're going to be talking with her tomorrow, and then Linda Carini is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about her wonderful book, Bear Speaks. Bear Speaks. Just great people, and I've got a wonderful lineup. So as soon as I can, I'm going to have it up on BBS, but we have to get through whatever this glitch is that we've got in our system. And then once that is taken care of, then I'll be sure to have everything posted for the remaining part of the month. We've just got great people out there in the world, and I just feel so privileged to be able to bring them to you because they all have wonderful, wonderful stories to tell. Okay, 888-815-9756. Do you feel like you could be a leader? Many times, we have ideas about leadership, and I wanted to share an idea of leadership that is with a man by the name of Ivan, Seidenberg. Now, experience, information, and wisdom we're supposed to gather as we mature, are we not? Usually when you talk to an older individual, you like to think that they have an understanding of how to cope with things. You are usually, when you get older, hopefully, you're not arrogant. And if someone asks your advice, you're very thoughtful about how you give it because you realize that your words can have an impact on someone. And if you're going to share your knowledge, you have to be discerning and discriminating about how you communicate. Well, Ivan was Verizon's chairman and CEO. He said when he was doing a job as a young person of janitorial work, he said his boss at that time taught him a lesson that he had never expected to experience. He watched Ivan's work habits for a year. Watched how he did things. Didn't tell him about what to do, but watched how he handled his responsibilities. Before, he mentioned to him another company where Ivan would be eligible for college tuition support. Now, Ivan, as a young man, is a little perplexed by this information that his boss gives him, and he asks why he waited so long to tell him about this opportunity. His boss said to him, I wanted to see if you were worth it. Now, Ivan said it wasn't his money, it wasn't even his company that he was referring this young man to, but it was his knowledge, and he wanted to bestow it only where it was deserved. In other words, he did not want to make a recommendation about Ivan until he really knew that Ivan could step up to the mark that the opportunity would bring him. And that is something I think is important. We need to set a standard for ourselves and a standard for those that we want to help out. A leader will watch, look, and listen, and then give a helping hand when he or she recognizes that that person is ready to accept that helping hand and make good use of it. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a minute. 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Rio. I'm the author of the cutting-edge book, Hooked on Raw. I want to give you and your loved ones the gift of optimum health. So when you order my book, Hooked on Raw, which has over 350 delicious, healthy recipes, I'll include my new DVD, What's Not Cooking in Rio's Kitchen, for a half price. Just go to my website, rawfoodinfo.com, and click on Holiday Special. That's rawfoodinfo.com. Click on Holiday Special.
Hi, this is Donna. I don't know about you, but after the holidays, I want cooking simple and easy, and it's like, okay, do I have something I can just add water to and just make it happen? But I do enjoy delicious foods, and often I can be quite innovative. We're finally getting rid of some of the leftovers from the holidays. Have you been going through that? Did you put some of the stuff in the freezer and you go, we really should get rid of this stuff? Okay, I know how that can be. Well, how about doing something with potatoes and chicken and doing it in a skillet? And not only will it smell good, make the house just absolutely awesome, or your apartment, wherever you are, but it's easy to do. And this is a great dish for leftovers, too. So I'll give that to you, so have a pad of paper and a pen handy. But one of the things I wanted to do also, and this is just sort of trivial stuff, is just toss out some suggestions that were passed along to me about how to, you know, recycle items that maybe you have around your house. And so many of you have young families, and these are some of the projects that you can get the whole family involved in if you want, especially the kids, because the kids really like this idea, and they really like to work with things. Now, one of the things that can be done, empty bottles of water or soda. You actually can do these with your milk cartons, you know, your plastic milk cartons, orange juice cartons, anything that is plastic. And this is, again, great for kids. You can use them in various ways. One person came up with a suggestion of using an empty bottle, like a soda bottle or a water bottle, for an ice pack. And they said all you have to do is simply fill the bottle with some water, leave some air space, about a good inch or two, and then close and freeze it overnight. You can add it to a lunchbox or an ice chest in the morning. And if you wanted to do that, of course, right here in the Pacific Northwest, we've got 20-some-odd degrees, so we don't worry about the ice chest right at this moment because everything's icy anyway outside. However, if you're wanting to have an ice pack of some kind, just think if somebody has an injury or maybe you've got, you know, a very, very sore muscles, you could do that too. Also, If you poke drainage holes in the bottom of one of these plastic containers, you can add soil, your favorite seeds, and you have got a wonderful, wonderful container for plants. And a 2-liter bottle is perfect for most people that have windowsills. And this is something to keep in mind, because if you have very confined quarters, but yet you'd like to have something growing, what about herbs? You could do that. You could use that with that. Also, if you want to make a funnel and you don't have one, cut off the bottom third of the soda bottle, uncap the opening, and pour away. So you can do that. They say the bottom third. For me, it's the upper portion. You've got a funnel, and just unscrew the top, and there you go. You've got it. So you help your kids with this, too. And it's something if you're getting some bedding ready for your gardens. And I know many people that they start even now working in their garden sometimes, getting some things prepared because they want to have something, you know, really nice for spring. An empty milk jug, you can make it into a scoop. You cut off the bottom at an angle and use the resulting scoop from the handle and the top of the jug. It's great for everything from kitty litter to dry dog food to whatever you want to use it for. And also, weights. Aha! How many of you have decided you want to do an exercise program? Well, those empty plastic jugs, fill them with water, and you're going to find that a gallon jug weighs 8.5 pounds, maybe just a little bit more than that. If you put sand in, it's going to be about 10 pounds, and you are not going to have to fill them to the top. You can add as much weight inside that container as you go, and it's very inexpensive. You don't have to go out and spend a whole bunch of money. Yeah, so if that's what you'd like to do, an empty soda can be turned in for kids to a musical instrument. Maracas, fill the can with sand or rice or dried beans or paper clips and tape the opening shut and shake. You've got a percussion instrument for kids. There's so many things that we can do with what we have. An empty coffee can, have you ever used one to make a cake or to bake bread in? I have. That makes wonderful round loaves of bread. And you can also fix them up if you want them to have a gift tin. So it all depends on what you want to do. You can cover them with your favorite colored paper, holiday, whatever it is that you've got. Put glitter on them. It's a wonderful project for kids. And say, how can we use this? Maybe you want to use it on your desk. Maybe you want to put photos on it of the family or your favorite dog or whatever. That's all kinds of things. So there's just these little treats that people, treats, I would say just suggestions that people gave to me, and I thought I would share them with you. Ooh, goodness, I think I'm going to have to give one of the horoscope signs. How about, let me see. You know, I did cover Virgo. Let me go to Libra. This is one, and I think I've got enough time to get a couple in here, and I'll have to give you the recipe tomorrow because it's just not going to work today. For those of you born under the sign of Libra, your 2011 winter horoscope, this is going to be something, you know what, I don't think I'm going to have time to do that either. My goodness, time is just going by so fast. Well, I'm just going to have to save this stuff for tomorrow and bring it up to you. Now, by the way, I wanted to let you know that there are going to be some upcoming activities, and some of the items have been mentioned in my newsletter that went out this past weekend. So go up to my website, and I think you're going to find it online. So you'll be able to get all the information about the upcoming guests and various other aspects. Also, I wanted to let you know I did a wonderful broadcast in London yesterday. And when that information comes out and when that interview is available, I'll be sure to let you know about it via the show, as well as an email posting that is going to be going out to let you know where you can pick up the show and how you can listen to it. There have just been some wonderful opportunities for me to interact with talk show hosts in different parts of the globe, and so this is the first one for this year, and I'm really, really pleased for the opportunity. So that will be shared with you. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Our guest, Jim Hannon, today has done something that more people are going to be doing. They are going to say, we've had enough. It's time for us to wake up out of our sleep of ignorance, fear, and superstition and move in to to a world that is going to be better, not just for ourselves, but for those that we love, our friends, our family, for people not just where we are alone, but also around the globe. You make a difference. Don't ever forget that. You're very significant. This is Donna. Hope you'll join me tomorrow. We're going to be talking about a lot of good stuff. Have a wonderful day or evening wherever you are. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.